This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
This is Alex Smith, back with more of The Awful Truth on Radio EcoShock. Let me ask you, do you have days when you feel like we're doomed as a species? That's every day for our next guest. When a successful professor of natural resources, ecology, and evolutionary biology left the University of Arizona for his mud hut retreat, he probably didn't intend to stir up the world. But that's just what Guy McPherson has done. He's become a voice for the worst fears of many scientists. In fact, McPherson says climate change has gone so far, so fast, humans will become extinct before 2050. Dr. McPherson makes his case and offers ways to cope with the ultimate bad news in a new book co-authored with psychologist Carolyn Baker. It's called Extinction Dialogues, Living with Death in Mind. That's coming out this fall. Let's find out why Guy McPherson thinks we are finished. Guy, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks, Alex. It's a pleasure to be with you again.
Well, so you're just back from Belize. What was going on there?
I was just doing a little consulting work. People are developing homesteads, and I developed what I consider the platinum-grade homestead here in New Mexico. So I have a little practical, hands-on experience, as well as the initials that follow my name that some people think are important. So people ask me to show up in exchange for travel expenses. I'll provide advice on just about anything.
And I gather you have been telling people around the country and beyond that we're heading for a fatal shift of the climate. How is that being received?
Well, it depends a lot. I would say a vast majority of the people, probably in the range of three-quarters or so of the people, push back pretty hard with comments like that can't happen to us, we're too clever, it hasn't happened yet, so clearly it'll never happen. People have been saying the same kind of thing for thousands of years, and look, here we are, still here. So there's a lot of pushback. On the other hand, relatively few people take in the evidence I present, absorb it, and then live differently, live as if the day were here, to quote Nietzsche, and try to experience deeply each moment. And so it seems that there's two ends of the spectrum and very little in between.
Is anyone in the mainstream media willing to talk about this guy?
Well, I'm not sure. I think mainstream is maybe a continuum rather than the end of a line or a box to fit in. Dar Jamal, who wrote a couple of books based on his experience as an unembedded journalist in Iraq, is writing about it. And Tom Hartman and Abby Martin both had me on their television shows with RT. Not exactly MSNBC, but they do have a considerable reach.
Yeah, I think Hartman and RT, that's getting there once you get some television talk going about it. I'd like to get to some of the science, and I know this is a huge topic. I've gone through some of the science that you've put out, and you do take care to collect science from all over the world. Could you say who are the leading scientists that drive you to conclude we cannot survive global warming?
Well, Tim Garrett's epic paper written 7 years ago, and I know you've had him on your show, his paper from that he wrote seven years ago that was actually published in November 2009 online and then finally made print media in February 2011, that's a great piece of work indicating that civilization is a heat engine and that until we terminate civilization, we're always going to be ratcheting up the damage. There is quite a bit of evidence at this point from the likes of Paul Beckwith, for example, that we're headed for the abyss. Although Paul would not use those words, and perhaps doesn't even believe that we are headed for our own extinction, even though he predicts up to 16 C temperature rise within a couple of decades, and that prediction was made more than a year ago. In any event, those are a couple of the names. Beyond that, I comb the refereed journal literature, and I come across names like Jason Box, who mostly studies ice on Greenland, but he's been interviewed on broader topics recently. And then the refereed journal literature from, you know, Nature and Science and Geophysical Research Letters and Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences and on and on and on it goes. So when you put all the information together, it appears that, first of all, the clathrate gun has been fired.
Now, we should clarify that. What's the clathrate gun, please?
Right, so the clathrate gun is the phenomenon James Hansen worried about most in his book, Storms of My Grandchildren. It's the topic most studied by climate scientist Paul Beckwith at the University of Ottawa. And it refers to the class rates, or hydrates, those are synonyms, which are chemical cages around methane molecules in the shallow seabed of the Arctic Ocean. So those class rates, or hydrates, with a little bit of warming, start to bubble up to the surface, and then the hydrate breaks, the chemical chain breaks, and releases the methane into the ocean, or worse yet, directly into the atmosphere. And it's methane that has been implicated in many of the major extinction events, that carbon dioxide drives the show for a while, atmospheric carbon dioxide. But then at some point, the methane is released from the shallow seabed of the Arctic Ocean and also from permafrost, from under the boreal forests of the world. So those two in combination, those two major sources of methane in combination, have been major contributors to extinction events in the past. They both seem to be going full scale at this point.
Well, I could add a couple of names to this list. I mean, Dr. James Hansen, formerly of NASA, has wondered whether there are any limits to climate change, and he studied Venus and thinks that it's possible, not likely, but possible, that we could blow off the atmosphere altogether, and that would certainly lead to the extinction of all life as we know it. And then you have conferences like the 4 degrees or More conference in Australia. John Schellenhuber from Germany suggested if we reach 4 degrees, the whole thing could easily slide to 8 degrees. He listed some physics reasons, which I didn't totally understand, but he does. And I think we could agree that 8 degrees is beyond the level of human tolerance, would you say?
Oh, absolutely. I have my serious questions about humans surviving 4 C, for the simple reason that humans have never experienced life on this planet at 3.5 C above baseline, meaning the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. At 4C, according to quite a bit of the journalist literature out there, at 4C, all we can prepare for is extinction.
Now, many of the big-name scientists, though, other than James Lovelock, hedged their warnings with the idea we could still save ourselves if we mount a huge campaign to switch energy to renewables and stop our carbon-wasting ways. Guy, why do you say it's too late for all that?
Because it seems pretty clear to me that the class rate gun has been fired based on refereed journal articles in Science and Nature and geophysical research letters, and the list goes on, as well as NASA's CARV project. That appears to be a self-reinforcing feedback loop. And on the topic of self-reinforcing feedback loops, there's another 36 to go in addition to that one. And they not only feed themselves, that is, as methane is released, it gets warmer, and that allows for increased methane release from the shallow seabed of the Arctic Ocean. Not only that, but as warm Atlantic water is defrosting the Arctic by shooting through the Fram Strait off the north and east coast of Greenland, that causes an increased warming of the Arctic Ocean, and therefore allows the release of more methane. So these are phenomena that are not only feeding themselves, but they're feeding among other feedbacks as well.
Yeah, I can think, too, of things like Arctic fires. They're larger every year due to climate change, and their soot causes more and earlier melting, and that leads to an extended fire season, and that leads to more fires. And this is one of the things that I really do appreciate about your work, Guy McPherson, because you are adding up these positive feedback effects where it seems like the scientists that I talk to are all working on one or the other, and they don't look at how they intermingle. Is that your opinion as well?
Yes, absolutely. And a big part of that is because of the way our society works generally and the way academia works specifically. You get rewarded in academia for the silo you settle into and for gaining some notoriety within that relatively small silo. And there is little to no interaction across the silos, despite university administrators' comments to the contrary. In the more than 2 decades I was at universities, I didn't see any significant encouragement for people from different departments to interact with each other. And in fact, instead, I saw plenty of discouragement for people who were trying to pursue such a path.
This is Radio EcoShock with my guest, Dr. Guy McPherson. He says the human species will be wiped out by our own careless pollution. Now, Guy, one place where you and I disagree is that, as far as I understand it, you've given a specific year for human extinction. When is that, and how do you arrive at a date?
Well, instead of providing providing my own date, I continue to present the evidence developed by other scientists. So the only analysis I've seen of the clath rate done indicates more than 4C warming by 2030. That's based on an exponential projection of temperature going forward from the firing of the clath rate gun in maybe 2010 or so. It appears now that the clath rate gun probably was fired in 2007. So that goes to more than 4C by 2030. Paul Beckwith's analysis indicates 6C within a decade. That was from late 2012, which I don't see any way for humans to survive 6C, considering we've never been on the planet when it was 3.5 degrees C above baseline in the past. And Beckwith goes on a year later to predict 16C within a decade or two. And so that takes us to, 2033, I guess, with 16C. And that's the latest possible date for that prediction, would be 2033. So I think 2030 is not an unreasonable date to expect extinction of our species. I don't see any way, really, we make it till 2040 or 2050, given that these feedbacks are reinforcing among themselves as well as within themselves. And both of those analyses, the exponential analysis by Sam Corana, the prior analysis by Malcolm Light, and then the two separate analyses and predictions by Paul Beckwith, all of those are based solely on the single feedback of methane being released from the shallow Arctic Ocean.
So I know that many listeners are already raising objections, and I'm sure that you've heard them all in your talks. But first of all, I want to ask you, how rigorous are you in your definition of extinct? Do you mean civilization disappears, leaving a few stragglers near the Arctic Circle, as James Lovelock suggested? Or do you mean not a single member of the human species left on the planet?
I'm a conservation biologist, and when I say extinct, I mean every member of the species is gone.
Wow. Personally, I think the climate is too complex with too many unknowns to predict if we will become extinct, much less when. But, Guy, consider this. The whole scientific world is surprised Earth didn't warm as fast as they thought, given the huge amounts of carbon we've been emitting. Some call it a warming hiatus due to the heat being absorbed by the ocean. What do you think about that?
I think scientists, not surprisingly, have not been paying attention to their own refereed journal literature. And this is a classic case. I keep hearing about this hiatus, and it's just not there. It is just absolutely not there. Completely contrary to the contrarian myth, global warming has accelerated with more overall global warming since 1997 than the period before then. And we've known this now since a paper was published in March of 2013 in Geophysical Research Letters. And yet, I don't see any reference to it in the refereed journal literature or in presentations given by climate scientists. So there hasn't been a pause, as it's often called. Instead, there's been a pause in land surface records, but that's less than a third of the planet. The heat has been going into the ocean. We know it's been going into the ocean since March of 2013. It's time for scientists to wake up and start reading their own literature. It's absurd to me that we keep hearing about this hiatus or pause when, in fact, there's been an acceleration, a rapid acceleration, even going to the deep ocean down below several hundred meters. It's pretty hard to warm up the deep ocean, but the acceleration of the heating of the deep ocean has persisted since 1997 when there was a so-called pause. Now, bear in mind, then in 1997, that's the date many people point toward as the start of the pause or the hiatus. Well, in 1997, there was a pretty profound El Nino event. So land surface temperatures reached a really, really high level at the time, an all-time high level. And so when we see the next El Nino event, whenever that is, we're going to see a tremendous amount of heat released by the ocean, and land surface records are going to skyrocket, I suspect, to a new all-time record.
Yeah, you're talking about one of the scariest things for me, because the Australian climate scientist Matthew England studied this overturning of ocean currents in the Pacific, and he says such benefits of sort of hiding the warming somewhat cannot last more than about a decade, and given what we know about these ocean cycles, the hiatus, if there is one, won't happen again for more than a century. So all that backlog of heating that we've created could hit us before 2030 and won't stop again this century. You know, I wish it was the other way around, that somehow heating hit us too hard, too fast, and then we'd wake up and do something about it. But instead, it's almost being hidden by this natural process. I'm worried about it.
I think you're justifiably worried about it. I think it's cause for major concern. And I don't see very many people in positions of influence being concerned about it or expressing that concern in any event.
Well, let's try and picture this road to extinction. You said it could happen pretty quickly, perhaps just 25 years from now. As a professor with expertise in evolutionary biology, you have serious expertise. Can you try to describe a scenario that would wipe us out? And take a little time if you need it.
Well, it's all about habitat. So clearly we are capable of adapting to pretty warm temperatures, especially using the tools of industrial civilization. So it's not that we can't go from a really cold day outside, walk into the inside of a building, and experience a 30°C temperature rise in a matter of a few seconds. We do that pretty regularly in the wintertime or here in the summertime when we go from inside to out. Rather, the problem is one of habitat. And so here again is where an ecological background is beneficial. We need habitat, and we don't just need air and water. We need food, too. Again, based on the Referee Journal literature, there's a 30% increase in the acidification of the oceans within the last few decades based on a 0.85°C rise in temperature, and that carbon dioxide being pushed into the ocean at that higher temperature. And we talked about the heat being stored in the ocean right now. And that's having major consequences for marine life, for almost all marine life. It could be that in the relatively near future, again, based on the Referee Journal literature, we have an ocean that's full of jellyfish and not much else. In fact, there's a recent line from the author of a paper, and I'm not going to be able to come up with a reference off the top of my head, but again, it's in the Referee Journal literature, and the author concludes that we could lose all of the ocean's phytoplankton in the relatively near future. Well, that's the base of the marine food web, and loss of the marine food system for humans means loss of about half our food. The other half comes in the form of land plants, one way or another, and we're already seeing devastating impacts on land plants, again, at 0.85°C. The so-called polar vortex or Rossby wave or meandering of the jet stream is responsible for large-scale destruction of the winter vegetables in Mexico, in the southwestern United States, and also death of a lot of citrus trees in the same region. And that's just at 0.85°C. So we have this meandering jet stream that takes cold air from the Arctic and drags it way further south than we've ever experienced in the last several thousand years at least. And at the same time, we see very warm weather being dragged up north into areas that are supposed to be cold in the wintertime. The combination for plants that have developed adaptations for a particular place is truly devastating. So we're seeing large-scale reduction of all kinds of organisms throughout the world, but especially in the northern hemisphere, where that meandering jet stream comes into play so strongly. So it wouldn't surprise me at all if within a decade or two, we managed to destroy virtually all land plants in the world because of these tremendous fluctuations in temperature at a local level.
Did the three nuclear meltdowns in Fukushima, Japan, add to your sense that we won't make it? Is that part of the story?
Absolutely. If we maintain industrial civilization into the future, we cause so much heating, again, as Tim Garrett's work has pointed out, that it drives us to our own extinction. And it looks like, in fact, we've already triggered so much damage that's irreversible that we're already headed for extinction as a result of climate change. If we shut down industrial civilization, on the other hand, that means that we experience the catastrophic meltdown of the world's 400 and change nuclear power facilities. And just Fukushima alone represents a significant threat to habitat for humans in the northern hemisphere. So the fact that it takes at least 20 years, and according to David Jasko, I think that's his first name, most recent ex-head of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission in the United States, according to him, it'll take up to 60 years, maybe more, to shut down Indian Point nuclear power plant. Well, if there's one thing I'm relatively certain of, it's that we don't have 60 years left of industrial civilization. And even if we did, I don't see any leadership that is causing people to decommission nuclear power plants. Rather, we're commissioning new ones, at least in this country, rather than decommissioning them. I think that ought to be priority one for anybody in a position of leadership, is to immediately start decommissioning, shutting down safely nuclear power plants around the world. But I don't see any evidence of that happening.
All right. Now, two quick objections that I know you've heard 1,000 times. Optimists suggest a human awakening could happen, and the world connected by social media could happen really quickly. And they give the example of the Second World War, when America stopped making automobiles overnight and the whole population accepted massive change. Do you discount that kind of last-minute turnaround?
I have serious reservations about what that would look like. Are we asking people to terminate civilization? Because according to the Referee Journal literature, that's what it takes to prevent runaway greenhouse. I suspect runaway greenhouse is already underway based on several analyses. But let's say it's not. Are we going to convince 7 billion people in the world that they can't have any of their toys anymore? That we can't have water running through the taps? That we can't have food delivered to the grocery store or gasoline to the gas stations? I just don't see any way that 7 billion people are going to vote for that.
Yeah, there's a little voice in me saying, hell no, we'd rather die first. And we may. Well, what about technology? Some people hope we'll invent a machine to remove carbon or at least use geoengineering to cool the planet. How can you be sure we won't save ourselves that way?
Well, there's no such thing as 100% certainty, of course. So it could be that the miracle shows up and we come up with some civilized means to reverse the damages being caused by civilization. It could happen. I don't see much evidence of that on the horizon. People have been working on that for a while. Geoengineering has been discredited widely in the Referee Journal literature, and even the people don't seem to be on board on it based on poll results. So I don't think geoengineering is the answer. I don't know what the answer is, but I suspect attempting to use tools of civilization, which is the root of the problem. Civilization is the root of the problem, as Tim Garrett's work points out. So trying to create tools from civilization to solve this predicament induced by civilization seems like it's headed the wrong direction to me.
Okay, now just shifting topics a little bit. After Kolapsnik and radio host Michael C. Ruper took his own life this year, people in the climate movement stopped to consider their own mental health, and I'll be talking about that with your co-author Carolyn Baker. But has it been hard for you too?
Which part?
Well, just realizing that, we're doomed, as you think. It must be tough.
Oh, yes. I thought you were referring specifically to the death of my friend, Mike Rupert, which was hard on me as well.
Mm-hmm.
And, yes, is it hard knowing that we don't have as long as I thought we would? The typical sort of professorial life for those who are successful in the academy, for those who make full professor, for example, as I did, is to persist in that career until the age of 70 or so, and then retire and happily travel around the world during the golden years of retirement. Well, when I hit the age of 70, that'll be the year 2030. Either we won't have civilization or we won't have habitat for humans at that point, and I suspect both, in fact. So things didn't work out quite as I'd planned when I got into this game. On the other hand, I'm a conservation biologist, and I've known for a very long time that I was going to die and that all species go extinct. Obviously, that doesn't make it any easier beyond intellectually, but I have had a relatively long time to take into account those ideas. So when I deliver presentations now, I try to encourage people to live with death in mind. And in fact, that's the subtitle of the book by Carolyn Baker and I, is How to Live with Death in Mind. I'm trying to take some of my own advice for a change and take advantage of each moment and live and breathe deeply in those moments and to experience life as probably I could have and should have always been experiencing it, rather than waiting for the tomorrow that never comes.
Pretty sound advice, I think. Does this book include your long list of scientific reasons why climate change has entered an unstoppable runaway state? Does it include notes to the original source material so readers can check for themselves?
Yes. And in fact, for the last couple of weeks, I've been checking and rechecking every one of the hundreds of citations in the book. And I'm about two-thirds of the way through. It looks like I have another 10 or 12 hours yet to go in checking those citations and making sure they're all in a place that anybody who has access to a library or a computer can track down the founding documents.
Guy McPherson, I've heard you're starting a radio show. What's that about?
The radio show has been broadcast four or five times already. It's a weekly show, Tuesday nights at 8 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. That's PRN.FM. I'm co-hosted with my friend Michael Sliva. Mike and his wife Karen walked away from their very successful positions as high school teachers 3 years ago and came out and spent 3 months with me here at the Mud Hut in New Mexico. So Mike and I have had many long conversations that we think are about important topics, and we wanted to make sure everybody had an opportunity to listen in on our conversations because we think they're really pretty important. And so we have a radio show on PRN.FM.
Well, I'll put a link to that in my show blog at ecoshock.info so people can find you. Can you tell listeners where to find your popular blog, Nature Bats Last, and your Facebook or Twitter connections if you have any?
Sure, and they're all accessible at the blog, which is guymcpherson.com. No A's in McPherson, but I suspect even if you spell it wrong, you'll find it with only a click or two. And they're... are links there to all the social media I'm engaged in. I have a couple of Facebook pages and a Twitter page, and you can find them all there at guymcpherson.com.
Our guest has been Dr. Guy McPherson, Professor Emeritus from the University of Arizona. He left his academic career to specialize in the future of humanity and then found we don't have much of a future left. His new book, co-authored with Carolyn Baker, is Extinction Dialogues, Living with Death in Mind. Guy, where can people find out more about the book?
They can go to Taeyen Lane Publishing's website, taeyenlane.com, T-A-Y-E-N-L-A-N-E, taeyenlane.com. Or they can go to, again, guymcpherson.com and click on the tab that says My Books or something like that, and it'll take you down the list of my books, and the last one is the forthcoming book with Carolyn Baker.
This is Alex Smith, Guy McPherson. Thank you so much for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex. It's been a pleasure, as always.
Radio EcoShock.
That's a hard interview to hear if you love life. Don't sell your possessions or make that goodbye video just yet. Be sure and tune in next week when my guests and I try to make the case that humans won't go extinct anytime soon. Think deeply about what Guy McPherson says, but don't miss next week's show.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio. For the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. Adding up climate change, species extinction, the poisoning of a planet, is it really time to say goodbye to the future? How do you feel about that? To explore our responses to ultimate threats, I've called on a repeat Radio EcoShock guest. Carolyn Baker is a one-woman whirlwind, really. She produces a daily news service with some of the bleakest headlines from around the world, plus some tips for more positive living. She's the author of several books, including Sacred Demise, Navigating the Coming Chaos, A Handbook for Inner Transition, and Collapsing Consciously, Transformative Truths for Turbulent Times. She's been a leader in the transition movement. Following the untimely death of Michael C. Rupert, Carolyn is the host of the popular Lifeboat Hour radio show every Sunday night on PRN. She has expertise in psychology, and now she's the co-author with retired academic Guy McPherson of a challenging new book coming out this fall. It's titled Extinction Dialogues, How to Live with Death in Mind. If you have dark feelings that things are not going too well, let's tune in to some ways to cope. Carolyn Baker, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Well, thanks for having me, Alex. It's really wonderful to be back. I always enjoy our interviews.
Yeah, me too. And, you know, before we dive into your new book, I just want, for listeners, could you outline your credentials in psychology?
Yeah, I have a PhD in counseling psychology and a master's in history.
Good enough. All right. Now, Dr. Guy McPherson made the case that threats to nature are so extreme, humanity faces extinction relatively soon, possibly within the lifetimes of those alive now. Do you agree with him?
Well, you know, I am reluctant to set any dates. Guy McPherson and some of his colleagues have talked about the number 2030 as a possible time of extinction. He doesn't really say it's going to be on that date, per se, but he often says, I can't imagine, you know, the human species continuing after such and such a time. I think it's really uncertain. But I do believe that by mid-century, we're going to be in terrible trouble if we're still here. And I seriously doubt that we will be here by 2100 as a species.
I'm with you on one point here. On the way to 2050, I think there will be many horrible developments. Water's already running out in the U.S. Southwest, as you know very well. And when the last of the water tables pumped out in India and China, which is starting to happen, I think we'll see tens of millions, maybe even hundreds of millions of people die right on TV, assuming that world reporting is still functional. But I think we humans, we have a capability, don't we, to accept that they are dying somewhere over there without realizing that we may be next. What is the psychology behind that kind of separation?
Well, it's the kind of psychology of industrial civilization that stems from the Enlightenment that says everything is getting better and better all the time. We're getting smarter and smarter, stronger and stronger. And, you know, we, through this paradigm of the Enlightenment, we've been able to completely separate death from our door. It's not going to really happen to us. You know, I was also just looking, and I'm kind of disclosing what's going to be in tomorrow's digest, but I was just looking at a clip from a new film that filmmaker Ian McKenzie up in your neighborhood of the world is putting out, interviews with Stephen Jenkinson, who's been called the Grief Walker. And he talks about what is the meaning of death. And this culture does not get it that death is a part of life. Stephen Jenkinson says the meaning of death isn't found at all, it's made. And, you know, he says, hold dear the fact that nothing you hold dear lasts. So we don't really get that as a culture. Many other cultures are much more accustomed to the process of death as a part of life. They aren't as terrified of it as we are. They don't need to divorce themselves from it. You know, I've been talking about planetary hospice. We'll probably get into that in this interview. But I think that is a concept that we need to become much more comfortable with.
I'm trying to picture, Carolyn, what would happen if somebody goes to a mainstream psychologist or psychiatrist now with a deep fear about the future and it's making them uneasy. How do you think they might handle that?
Well, I don't think I know, because I have people coming to me for life coaching. I don't practice psychotherapy anymore, but I have people coming to me for life coaching who have been to psychotherapists who are totally clueless about all of this and think that the person is having anxiety attacks or they have clinical depression, and usually the therapist prescribes medication for them and pathologizes what they are feeling about the future. And that's why a lot of people do come to me, and also to Guy McPherson, for life coaching, because they need a reality check. They need somebody who's going to say, yeah, I'm taking this very seriously as well, and you're not crazy.
You know, I recently spoke with George Marshall in Wales, and he claims humans are hardwired to avoid thinking about ultimate threats like climate change. We don't want to talk about it. At work, at family gatherings, you can be very unpopular if you bring this up. Really anywhere, where can we find the space to talk about these unspeakable big realities?
Well, I would just partially disagree with what Marshall says, because I think in a lot of indigenous cultures, people are very willing to talk about these threats, and it's really the indigenous cultures that are making headlines right now as far as preparing for climate change and adapting resiliently to it. You know, you don't hear much about that in this country and in Western civilization. So there's that. And then on Facebook right now, there's a wonderful support group that has over 2,000 members, the Near-Term Extinction Support Group. And there's some very interesting conversations on there. I don't have time to be on Facebook a lot, but when I do go to that support group, I find it to be very helpful. And I have coaching clients who tell me it's very helpful to them. So I would highly recommend that.
Do you think we need a warning label for some of what we're talking about here? I mean, the group that's least willing to hear about extreme climate change is not the Republican Party, according to polls, but young mothers. And I'm wondering if people who are having babies right now should avoid your new book or maybe my radio show. And what about people who are already battling depression and possibly they have suicidal urges? Should they stay out of that extinction dialogue until they feel better? What do you think?
Well, you know, I think it depends. I don't think you can, lay down a blanket ruling on this, but a person who's heavily depressed, they may want to stay away from this. They may want to take breaks. I don't think any of this can be dealt with in isolation. People need support for this, which is why these conversation groups are so important, why life coaching with me or Guy is so important, so that you're not alone with this information. And in terms of children, you know, I get that question a lot. How do I talk to my kids about this? And my answer is very honestly, I mean, you don't lay all this stuff on a 5-year-old, but as they begin to ask questions and as you begin to interact with them in the home, talk to them about this in terms of what they're ready for. And, by the time they're teenagers, they may be wanting to have the big talk about death. I mean, I don't know. But I don't think it is wise to try to shield our children from knowing about this, because they're going to hear about some of it in school. They're going to hear about some of it in the media. And so it has to be talked about.
I agree. I really do. But I wonder now, in your radio show and in your blog at carolynbaker.net, you are leading people into ways to grieve. What is grieving and why should we be doing that for events that haven't happened yet?
Well, you know, that's a question that actually comes out of our enculturation in industrial civilization. A lot of indigenous cultures are very, very familiar with the grieving process. And in fact, the Dagara tribe of West Africa have regular grieving rituals. In fact, they have an African funeral once a week, even if nobody dies. The reason for that is that they believe that when we build up grief and we don't express it with support of the community, then we poison the community. And one of my favorite voices on the importance of grieving is California psychotherapist Francis Weller, who wrote a book called Entering the Healing Ground, Grief, Ritual, and the Soul of the World. And this is what he says about grief. Grief is the work of mature men and women. It is our responsibility to be available to this emotion and offer it back to our struggling world. The gift of grief is the affirmation of life and of our intimacy with the world. So I talk about grieving a lot. I do grieving workshops. I go to different places in the country where people want me to do grief rituals. And this is a really, really central part of coming to terms with catastrophic climate change and the end of life.
This reminds me of the series The Decameron. The medieval Italian author Giovanni Boccaccio wrote about different reactions to the plague, which was killing off about half the population around him, the Black Death. And he said there were two major responses. One was to become very religious, to weep openly, and the other was to party as though there was no tomorrow. Don't you think we'll see both? And if so, why should we grieve rather than celebrate the days we have left?
Well, I think we should do both. I don't see this as either or. I want people to really, really get familiar with grieving and to experience the intimacy that happens as a result of grieving, intimacy between themselves and other people, between themselves and the earth, and the intimacy that happens between themselves and themselves. It takes them deeper into who they really are. At the same time, as you know from reading my books, I'm a proponent of experiencing joy and creating beauty and celebrating and just living in the present as much as we possibly can to get everything out of life in the moment. And this is what Guy and I talk about in the book as living lives of excellence. It's not about achievement. It's about quality of life in the time we have left.
Well, thinking about you in the book, I was drawn to National Geographic. You know, it's one of the few mainstream publications that seem to be waking up to our danger. They've just written about the extinctions of many animals, including 1,300 species of birds, and they pose that as a warning that we could be next. It may sound strange, but Carolyn, sometimes I'm more ready to grieve the loss of a beautiful bird or a plant than I am for my own species. What do you make of that?
Well, I think that if we have any awareness at all about what humans are doing to the planet, we're going to have some hostility toward humans. And we're going to have great compassion for animals. And I want to really emphasize and support compassion for animals and birds and other species. I think it's very important that, as Francis Weller says, we practice good manners toward them and make their descent as easy as possible and bear witness to their suffering. I think that's really important. But we also have to be very careful that we don't get into extreme hostility toward our own species. A few months ago, I wrote an article on my website and sent it out to subscribers called Mad Hominem, because I talked about in that article how important it is not to be raging at our own species and developing this hatred for our own species, because when we do that, we really end up hating ourselves. So we need to grieve for what we have done and have remorse for what we have done to the planet, but also have great compassion for the more-than-human world and for our own human world. And that's part of the service that we need to be engaged in right now. Service is extremely important. And if we have time, I want to give you 10 things that I think we should be doing right now.
Well, let's do that in just a second. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with our guest Carolyn Baker. Her new book with Guy McPherson is called Extinction Dialogue, and I'm anxious to hear these 10 things. Please go ahead.
Yeah, as you know, I've been talking a lot about how I see us in a state of planetary hospice, and I'd like to suggest that people Google planetary hospice. It is an article by a man named Jiwa Woodbury, who was on my radio show a few weeks ago. Just Google Planetary Hospice and you'll get his article. It's a fabulous article to really chew on and assimilate. And so I believe that we are in a hospice condition as a species. And I think that, number one, it's important to recognize that we're patients in hospice. We've admitted ourselves, whether we realize it or not, and that we really have no control over what's happening right now in terms of the catastrophic climate change. It is bringing extinction to a number of species, including eventually our own. Secondly, begin living your life as a hospice patient might, because there's no other way of living that any longer makes sense. Every relationship, every act, every experience is deeply meaningful. Live it as if it were the last, and live with passion. Thirdly, commit to a time of self-reflection daily. Consider journaling about your life and your relationships, your past contributions to the Earth community, what worked for you and what didn't, what brought you joy and meaning and what didn't. Practice a meditation technique daily. Fourth, make a list of people to whom you would like to make amends. Even speak to them directly if possible, and if not possible, write them a letter that you can't or choose not to send, because making amends is really for you as much as it is for them. Fifth, make a list of people whom you want to thank for what they have contributed to your life. Sixth, deeply evaluate your life in terms of your time commitments and activities. Structure at least several hours a week of service into your routine. If you're in a service profession, notice what else you might be doing beyond what you're being paid for. Make extinction as easy on other species as you can. Seven, spend 1 hour a week in nature. Allow yourself to wander with your senses fully engaged. Watch, listen, smell, taste, touch the many facets of nature that you encounter. Eight, immerse yourself in love, giving it and receiving it. Be aware of what keeps your heart closed to certain people and situations. Guy McPherson, back in 2012, wrote a wonderful article called Only Love Remains. I suggest people Google that and read it. I have a book coming out in March called Love in the Age of Ecological Apocalypse, The Relationships We Need to Thrive. Number nine, immerse yourself in fun, play, and joy. And number 10, create beauty, share beauty with others. And as Rumi says, Let the beauty of what you love be what you do.
Well, that was a fabulous list of 10, and I think what I would do is listen to that again. People can download this as a podcast, or they can go to my website at ecoshock.org to listen to this as an MP3 so you can get that whole list. I'm pretty sure you could go to Carolyn's website. Is it on your website, that
it's
list?
It's not on my website yet, but I certainly encourage people to order the book. We have Extinction Dialogues in ebook form. It'll be coming out at the end of September, beginning of October. Or you can get the hard copy or Kindle or whatever you like. And that list is in there for sure.
Well, let's get right to it. Extinction Dialogues, what can we expect to find in the book? What sort of book is it?
Well, you can expect to find a conversation between me and Guy McPherson. We talk about our backgrounds as professors, and one of the chapters is entitled From Professors to Prophets. We talk about the role of humor in our lives and our journeys to the place where we are now. And then there's a chapter, it's chapter 2, in which Guy gives what I call the hardest of hard science about the facts of catastrophic climate change. And in fact, the science is changing so quickly that he asked the publisher if he could just keep adding things every single week or few days until the book actually goes to press. So, you know, in terms of the science, that'll be a bit outdated very soon, but I've been blown away by reading the science, which is all in one place in Chapter 2, and then watching it change so quickly. And we talk about our spiritual journeys. We talk about how we have emotionally and spiritually come to terms with all of this. We talk about our relationship with death. And so it's a very rich book that as you read it, you're kind of watching us talk in a way. It's kind of like a transcription of an interview.
Well, I don't totally agree with that we will go extinct, but I think we're in for some tough times. As you know, I've said that to you in email, and I've said it on radio. We've been talking with speaker, author, radio host, and counselor Carolyn Baker. Her latest book with Dr. Guy McPherson is Extinction Dialogues, How to Live with Death in Mind. You can pre-order that book at carolynbaker.net. And I also subscribe to her very stimulating daily headline news service. Carolyn, thanks for being with us again.
Thank you so much for having me. I look forward to our next interview.
You bet. Possibly broadcasting to the real end of times. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. I hope you can tell I respect both Guy McPherson and Carolyn Baker, but at a gut level and in my brain, I object and disagree with their conclusions. In next week's Radio EcoShock show, we'll take a look at the other side of this argument, whether the impacts of climate change will move that fast, and how worthwhile human lives could continue into the long future. That's next week on Radio EcoShock. Now we need to make a leap from ultimate things to letting life into your own surroundings. It's kind of like leaping from a tall building to a backyard, but I do that daily. I interview a climate scientist and then go pick tomatoes from my garden. I trust EcoShock listeners can make that transition for this next interview. Sometimes big changes come one yard at a time. You know we need to move from lifeless lawn culture towards letting nature, yes, messy nature, occupy our landscapes and our lives. That's why I've called up Kim Ironman, the eco-beneficial gardener. Kim teaches at the New York and Brooklyn Botanical Gardens and gives talks and workshops across America. She's an award-winning certified horticulturalist and master gardener. Kim, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you so much, Alex.
I'm a passionate enemy of surrounding ourselves with sterile lawns. How about you?
Boy, absolutely. When somebody asks me for suggestions on what to do with their lawn, it's real simple. Remove it. I really suggest that people only keep the lawn that you absolutely must have if you're utilizing that lawn to play volleyball or you're really doing a lot of picnics or you're really using it. Other than that, get rid of it.
Well, why? Why should we change?
I call it the green desert, and in essence, it is an ecological wasteland. Now, turf grasses that we use here in the U.S. and also in Canada, and I'm based in New York, just so people know, those turf grasses are exotic plants that come from Europe. and they have not evolved here, and they're not adapted to our conditions. You might notice that lawns are really thirsty all the time. They need a lot of fertilizer, need a lot of care. They're not happy here. They don't really want to be here, but we kind of insist on having them. And they don't support our native species. So in contrast, some of our native grasses, which can be very beautiful, have evolved with our native species and might be, for example, a native grass might be the host plant for the caterpillar of a native butterfly. Butterfly adults eat nectar, but most caterpillars actually eat plant leaves and parts of plants. So that's a case in point. So what we've kind of forgotten in our landscapes is that connection between nature and the plants. And that's what I'm trying to get people to start embracing.
Well, you mentioned New York, and most of us are city dwellers. Can we still cultivate for nature in such an urban space?
Absolutely, and folks are doing it more and more. Roof gardens are a great example of dramatic differences that we can make in our urban landscapes. Even if you have a little backyard garden, you can make powerful differences. And community gardens are super important. And you can even plant in pots with some native plants that are indigenous to your area if you only have hardscape and you don't have any soil at all. What I tell folks is every landscape matters, no matter how small. And just so you know, I'm 16 miles north of Midtown Manhattan, and I am gardening on my own property on less than one-fifth of an acre. And I see what comes to my landscape and what doesn't come to my neighbors, and it's pretty powerful.
You know, I think one of the reasons people do have lawns is they're somewhat afraid of nature, and some of these critters can look scary. I'm thinking of beetles that look very scary, but they're totally harmless. You know, and I have spiders around my tomatoes that are frightening looking, but they're capturing the grasshoppers. So how do we get past this fear of nature?
Well, I think it just boils down to education and really starting young, getting our kids in school engaged with nature and understanding that nature isn't scary and that there are very few insects that are problematic. When people see bees, they often just freak out and want to run the other direction. And, you know, God forbid they don't want to plant for bees. But in fact, we've got about 4,000 species of bees that are native here in the United States. And they're pretty docile creatures. Unless you're getting near a nest, and native bee nests are quite small. In fact, most of our native bees are solitary insects that don't even congregate in nests. They're very docile, and they're nothing to be afraid of. We confuse those insects with yellow jackets and can be pretty ornery, and wasps, if you irritate wasps, can be ornery. But all of these insects have an ecological function. Wasps, for example, are fantastic predators on some of the insects that we don't want in our gardens and our landscapes. Now, I just did a video at an organic farm up in Vermont that I'll be posting on my website shortly, and I was talking about a plant that had a lot of bees on it, and I literally put my face right down in the middle of about 8 bees just to prove the point. They are more interested in nectaring than bothering me, so we got to get past that fear.
Now, Kim Ironman, if I sit back and let nature do whatever she wants to, the city will come round with various bylaws telling me to clean it up. How do we deal with those legal expectations and those of our lawn-oriented neighbors?
Well, there are kind of two points to discuss here. One is our viewpoint of what is attractive. So we've gotten a very neat and tidy aesthetic over the generations, and it's kind of unfortunate because we've gotten so intolerant of any kind of messiness in our landscape. So I would suggest that, first of all, we've got to take a little bit different approach. Everything doesn't have to be pruned and clipped. Everything doesn't have to be neat and tidy. Having said that, we still have to deal with neighbors who perhaps don't understand what we're doing. So here's some tips. Use what are called cues to care that show your neighbors that you know exactly what you're doing and why you're doing it. And there are some ways that you can do that. One, use some hardscape like a stone wall or some edging to define the area that you're gardening in. And it kind of shows to your neighbors that you're doing this on purpose. If you're going to keep any lawn, you might actually keep a little remnant just to show that, again, you're doing things intentionally. Use signage. There are some wonderful signs from places like the National Wildlife Federation or the Xerces Society, Beyond Pesticides. All these places have some great signage that we can put in our landscapes that show our neighbors we're gardening to support bees. We're trying to help monarchs. we're not using pesticides for reason. And these are all cues to care that we can use to try to educate our neighbors and make them understand us a little bit more, why we're doing what we're doing. But native gardens can be fairly neat and fairly formal. That's kind of a personal choice, but I encourage people to find the beauty in ecological function, not just how things look. And when you see a butterfly or a bee or a songbird, utilizing some of these plants that you've got in your landscape, there's a beauty to that that I think is as beautiful as any beautiful flower. So,
yes, you've really touched on some important things there. I think too many people see our property as completely separate countries from next door or the rest of the neighborhood. What about climate change and our gardening?
Yeah, it's a reality. Finally, we've admitted that climate change is here. It's a reality. We're going to have more extreme weather events. And the implications as gardeners are pretty serious. First and foremost, we've learned through science that biodiverse landscapes with lots of different species of plants, and of course wildlife as well, are much more resilient to the effects of climate change. So if you've got a reason, good reason to plant diversely, that's it right there. I try not to guess about how warm it's going to get and how quickly it's going to get warm. I try not to use too many species from other parts of the country that have not evolved here. We'll kind of have to take things as they come and see over time what species are being displaced by climate change and which ones are still hanging on. But I encourage folks, join your local native plant society. Get to know these folks. The membership is typically very inexpensive. In most states and most parts of Canada, you're talking about $50 or less a year for membership. Wonderful resources about native plants in your area. Get to know this information about plants that are appropriate for your site, because what I might be growing in New York may be completely inappropriate for you in Vancouver. So it's really important to stay regional and appropriate for your site.
How can people learn more from you online?
Well, visit my website, which is ecobeneficial, like it sounds, .com, so ECOBENEFICIAL, not easy to say, www.ecobeneficial.com. I've got a wonderful tip sheet, top 20 ways to create an eco-beneficial landscape. If you sign up for that, you can get a free download and get some tips. And ask me questions. I would be very happy to answer any questions from listeners that they might have about their particular situation.
Our guest has been Master Gardener Kim Ironman, making her case for opening the garden gate and our minds to let nature in. You can find her, as she says, at ecobeneficial.com. Thank you so much, Kim. It's been a delight talking with you.
Thanks so much, Alex. Appreciate it.
We're totally out of time. Find all our past programs at the website, ecoshock.org. Dig deeper into all the links for this week's program in my weekly show blog, published Wednesdays at ecoshock.info. I'm Alex Smith. Be sure and tune in next week for more Radio EcoShock.